Well, I'm not sure how we get all this on a business card, but it's great to have Phil Robertson join us, Scientific Director and Sustainability Lead for the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center. That's quite a mouthful.
It is indeed. It took a while to learn how to say that in one phrase.
So when you're on the elevator and somebody says, so what is it that you do? How do you answer that question?
We do bioenergy research. Try to turn biomass into energy to replace fossil fuels. It's a simple answer.
And give me give me a little bit more of explaining that to somebody who doesn't have a real deep scientific background. What is it that you're burning? What are you trying to develop into energy and
sure.
fuel?
So most people know biofuels from an ethanol standpoint. You know, 10% of the gasoline that we put in our tank is from corn grain. And that ethanol plays an important role in the bioeconomy for the farm sector in particular. But it's only a fraction of what could be produced. So, and it also has environmental consequences that we'd rather not deal with. There's another source of biomass that we could be using to create bioproducts and bioenergy, and that's cellulosic biomass. So this is grasses, trees, the parts of plants that we don't eat, and the research that's needed to turn that biomass into fuel and bioproducts is what the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center is all about.
When you look at the work we're doing at Michigan State, I know that Michigan State is joined with other institutions and in partnerships. How does that collaboration work when you're trying to achieve something scientifically that can't be done today but can be done tomorrow in working with other institutions?
Right. The GLBRC is a partnership primarily between the University of Wisconsin, Madison, and MSU. And the nature of science today is that the big questions are addressed in a collaborative way primarily, because no single discipline, no single scientist certainly has the capacity to address the complex questions that need to be answered. And so the extent to which we can promote collaborations that provide these opportunities for interdisciplinary and interlab collaborations is a strong predictor of success in these endeavors. And the Department of Energy recognizes this and awarded this the funding for the center some 10 years ago now, and then just renewed for at least another 5 years. And I think it's their acknowledgement of the need for these collaborations to occur in a center where you get more productivity than you would in an individual grants.
I think to cast back a little bit in history, Phil, Michigan State had one of the first actual Department of Energy funded fundamental plant research laboratories, the PRL. And I think you came as a part of that organization when it was a slightly different, it wasn't so it didn't have a focus as strongly as it does on sort of the biofuel energy question. And it was always a surprise that the Department of Energy was interested in plants and what you would look at USDA or NSF for other kinds of work. And as I think the Department of Energy felt that other agencies could pick up part of the plant science, the fundamental plant science work that I think Michigan State is really good at, the competition then was for one of these bigger collaborative bioresearch centers, 400 people involved. There are only three of these in the country, rather than a lot of smaller ones. I think it reflects what Phil talked about. But I want to hearken back to also a bit of your work, because you're worried about sustainability, not simply here, but throughout your career you've been involved with plant research, KBS. So tell us a little bit about you as a researcher, not the lab.
So I'm a biogeochemist. I'm an ecosystem ecologist. I study how organisms interact in ecosystems and how they produce biomass, how nitrogen is cycled, carbon is captured and stored. And I've worked in a variety of systems. They tend, in the more recent part of my career, they tend to be managed systems. And a way to understanding these systems better is a way to manage them more sustainably. And so we look at questions related to climate change, related to soil microbe plant interactions that affect plant productivity and yield and so on.
Our paths crossed a while ago in the context of Kellogg Biological Station and the still called the Long-Term Ecological Research Project,
does it
have a different name now?
It's long-term from the start, so it has kept its name.
And part of what we've been able to do, which is really a credit to Phil and his team, is well before it was fashionable to think about things as a system. People often looked at isolated parts of the effect of farming on water or a lake, the effect of crop rotation on productivity, and never as all of these factors as one whole. And Phil, you really began that work at KBS, you and your colleagues, well before we had the computer capacity in big data.
Mm-hmm.
But to knit together a system approach to all of these factors that now has become very, not only a sort of a world standard, but it's been going on for how long now?
The LTER, Long-Term Ecological Research Program, has been going on for 26 years. So, and you're absolutely right. The need to approach these questions from a system standpoint, where we see how these different pieces of the system interact in sometimes surprising ways to do sometimes surprising things, is a key part of understanding how these systems operate. And looking at things individually, you can make guesses as to how they fit together, but until you actually conduct experiments where you're watching all of these different pieces interact, it's really difficult to know what the, you know, what the emergent properties are, what the end result is. And that's especially important with biofuels, for example, because we could design plants that can produce a lot of biomass, but those plants may not be desirable from an ecological standpoint. So one of the promises of cellulosic bioenergy is that the process is largely, you know, agnostic. It doesn't really care what plants are being used. You could use corn, or you can use a native prairie plant to equal effect. And that gives us a lot of opportunities for designing ecosystems, even restored prairie, that can produce bioenergy in a very sustainable way, in a way that that provides conservation benefits that you don't get from annual crops on the landscape, for example.
So when the public comes to KBS over this 26 period of time, or you talk with them now about bioenergy, because the lab has a big public outreach program that was part of the understanding, and somebody says to you, well, gee whiz, if I look at U.S. energy supply, energy is as cheap as it's ever been. People tell me there's plenty of gas. So why do I need to worry about this?
So you're correct in that energy security was a big reason that that the DOE put a lot of effort into funding these bioenergy research centers 10 years ago. And energy security is a lot less important today. But the Department of Energy takes a longer view than many others in society and expects the energy supply eventually to diminish, the fossil fuel supply, either because of less fossil fuel to be extracted, or because of carbon tax or some other reason to use less fossil fuel. And when that happens, there will be an economic incentive to have products available that are produced from plants as opposed to fossil fuels. And so we have both an economic incentive from the long view, but also an environmental incentive in the sense that while we may have the energy security issue nailed down for now, we don't have the climate security issue nailed down. And the extent to which we can substitute biofuels, which are carbon neutral or better, for fossil fuels means the less CO2 ends up in the atmosphere and the less warming we face in the future.
When you're talking to end users of your research, I'm going to go through automotive and the like, is it a push or pull conversation? Are you telling different end users that, hey, we're onto something here, we're designing this, is this something you could use? Are you being asked, can you do some research and develop this for us as we're trying to move forward with where we're headed?
So I think there's a great willingness, if not excitement, on the part of the auto industry and other energy users to develop bioenergy as a substitute for fossil fuels, in part because most of them see the writing on the wall. Mm-hmm. And eventually we want to be, you know, taking automobiles, for example, eventually we want to be in a place where we're using primarily electric vehicles. But we know that we need a bridging technology because, for one, the grid can't handle electrifying all vehicles in the next 50 years. Mm-hmm. For two, it takes a long time for that infrastructure to be developed. And so in the meantime, we need to have what's called a liquid transportation fuels, some gasoline replacement over that period. And over the long haul, there are some transportation needs that can't be met by electricity. Airplanes, for example, would be unlikely to be able to carry batteries big enough to fly, and likewise long-haul trucking and so on. So there is quite a lot of interest on the industry side in building out this capacity.
I would say that, you know, go to the national security question. The Army, the other parts of the U.S. government are looking to the Department of Energy to fund this fundamental research that doesn't need it today, because this is really fundamental research that you don't imagine it's going to crop up, right now. But it is something to understand as you think about if, for example, in one of the scenarios that airplanes and ships that there's some that you stay away from nuclear, mm-hmm. but you do something else on ships or drones or whatever you want to pick as the vehicle of all of this, needs to have security of fuel that extends beyond relying on something pumped out of the ground. Yeah. And gasification, in order to get that fuel to turn gas into a liquid commodity and then into a fuel, is a very difficult, if not expensive, process.
Yeah, for now it's very expensive, and you know, it is doable. In fact, there are plants, that is to say, refineries that are converting cellulosic biomass into ethanol in this case, but it's an expensive proposition. And part of the research that is being conducted is aimed towards discovering ways to make it economically more feasible.
The other example of, I think, the energy piece is if you're in an area where electricity is expensive, and there are parts of the country for which that is true, particularly less populated parts of the country, the capacity to generate your own fuel to plug in your electric car is a very important commodity if you can also do it in a sustainable fashion, that instead of wasting the switchgrass that you've cut or the other kinds of products that aren't going into the food supply, but use it for fuel, then you have your own microgrid. It's like having your own solar panels on your house.
Yeah, that would be a very cool vision, yeah.
But that's part of, I think, how it might track into people in homes, mm-hmm. while we still worry about some national security issues as it relates to alternative fuel sources.
Right, and I think it's probably a mistake to think of it as a national security issue per se. Of course, the climate security is a national security issue, and yeah. You know, long term, it's all economics. And so, providing a capacity to avoid the need to load the atmosphere with carbon is going to be an important economic advantage, I think.
I think one of the things about fundamental research that if I look at the laboratory and some of the discoveries, and you can help me with the specifics here, that have found their way into more day-to-day life, what fundamental research does is work on things that are not needed today but maybe needed tomorrow. And if you don't plan for them today, you can't have them tomorrow. Mm-hmm. That's part of, I think, if you think about the history of PRL and some other kinds of things, there are lots of things that are now in the field that, if you think about your career here, were on that edge of not knowing what they were good for at the time you were thinking about them.
Leaving something behind for the next generation.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, I think, you know, there is one. Louis Pasteur had a good definition of the difference between basic and applied science, and it was, you know, basic science is simply science that isn't yet applied.
Yeah.
And it's you know, taking the long view, fundamental science effectively drives applied science in all cases. And so without the basic science, it's really difficult to foresee making the advances that we'll need in you know, for future life.
So 20 years from now, somebody heard you say something on this radio show that was exciting and couldn't believe it, and they said, I heard that back then. What's on the horizon? What's that thing out there that you think someone listening today would kind of go, yeah, sure, right, that you think might happen?
Yeah, so that's a really interesting question, a thought experiment.
I ask weird questions sometimes, I'm sorry.
Well, let's think about self-fertilizing crops. We know, for example, that that microbes and plants interact, and we know in some ways how they interact in soil, but mostly it's a black box. We don't really know very much about it, although we do know from other lines of evidence that probably the microbes are supplying the plants with nitrogen from the atmosphere, whereas in most cropping systems, we add nitrogen by fertilizer. But what if fundamental research were uncovering the ways that plants in unfertilized habitats, like old fields or prairies, were providing, were getting their nitrogen from microbes? And then we learned enough about it to take that capacity and build it into a crop plant. And that could lead to the avoidance of fertilizing plants and all the crop plants and all of the environmental problems that come from that. And that's, I would say, is pretty far out at this point.
Right. Pesticides are near term.
Yep.
If you want to, because that right now there are plants that are being, you know, thought about and grown in that are much more pesticide resistant. Therefore, it requires less pesticide. Therefore, it's good for people as well as the planet.
Right.
Is that
right? I mean, GMOs, genetically modified organisms, have largely to this point been designed to either be resistant to herbicides or resistant to pests. And while there is, you know, there are problems with respect to being on a treadmill from the standpoint of the pests evolving to overcome those built-in chemicals now, there certainly is promise eventually for building even more resistant plants.
So the use of phrase GMO, and GMO has taken on a meaning in some circles that has a more negative connotation. Right now, we're a sort of, but if I ask a person who's going in for one of these new medical techniques to help them deal with cancer or anything by gene therapy, it's a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
But that's really what we're doing, is a sort of gene therapy for plants, as opposed to creating something that introduces a whole different kind of critter into the plant.
Right. No, you could put it in those terms for sure. You're rearranging or inserting genetics that weren't there originally to improve plant resistance to stress of some sort, or building in a product, a bioproduct that wouldn't otherwise be there.
But we'll have, with big data, now the capacity to not simply introduce something, but maybe even modify through new gene therapy techniques what exists, as opposed to introducing something new into the equation.
Right. This new gene editing capacity in particular is going to provide a whole new avenue of adjusting the plant genome, as well as other organisms. Yeah.
So I think that's really the evolution, as people think about the change in plants. When I'm growing up, we worry about new corn varieties, we would detassel corn and do a lot of things to change and introduce some different gene into the mix through a very field-based, hands-on type breeding program.
Yeah.
And those weren't called genetically modified. Those were just hybrids along the way. But they did change the structure of the plant. Then we moved to more of a introducing of elements into the plant that became the GMOs. And now with gene editing, we have the capacity to take what's already there and not introduce any new elements in order to have those same kind of drought-resistant or pesticide-resistant or microbe-enhancing plants.
Right. And that's again, that's a whole new avenue that is effectively unexplored at this point. But
so that would be one of the answers I would have to Mark's question is, right. Is there's this new technology that is for animals, people, and plants is opening up just a whole new vista about how we think about plants that are great for people and great for the environment.
Yeah. I think from a bioenergy standpoint, bioproduct standpoint, what we'll have in the decades to come is a capacity to effectively grow our chemicals. So we have to remember that about 70% of a barrel of oil is used for energy, but the remaining 30% is also used, and that has to be replaced as well. So it's used for everything from lubricants to paints to cosmetics, plastics, and if we simply replace the energy without thinking about the other 30%, that means we're still going to be dependent on fossil fuels in the future for those.
When you're talking about GMOs and some of the other research that you're doing, if those that are listening to this show wanted to read up on more or wanted more information, wanted to talk to somebody, where would you suggest that they go? Probably a quick Google search, but what do they trust?
I think I would aim folks towards trusted sources, and I think the National Academy has done a great job of pulling together diverse stakeholders into committees that then address the really sticky questions and come to consensus on some answers. And so there have been a couple of National Academy reports on GMOs come out in the past 2 or 3 years, and the Academy does a reasonable job of translating those reports into, I would say, people-friendly language. And so I would start there.
Great.
And also recognize that the term is used in a variety of ways. Mm-hmm. And that's why the National Academy documents are important to separate out what might be some geopolitical economic ways in which that term is used, and also some historical ways, because science has changed over time.
It has. And I think the Academy, in much the same way that land grants act, they're honest brokers in the sense that they take in viewpoints and assess evidence and the science underlying that evidence from multiple sources. They have no particular donor or patron to satisfy. So.
To end back to the long-term ecological research project that you began a while ago, if one were to look at that research project over time, we've learned new things. And some of the things we're learning busted the myths that we were in the first 5 years of the project. And now that we've learned more and we know more about how things interact, we have new understanding and knowledge. I think when people look at that, sometimes they think that the first piece of knowledge that happened in the first five years was wrong, and now we're right. Mm-hmm. We just know more. Mm-hmm. And that's the great thing about science is you know more. And it doesn't mean you were wrong the first time and you're right this time, because you may learn more in the future that will modify and affect that position. But that's what great scientists do. They're prepared to take that learning and apply it without being committed to what they learned 10 years ago or 15 years ago. And you've been a great scientist and spokesperson for plant sciences in general and new bioenergy work of today. So thank you for being a part of Team MSU.
Phil Robertson, thank you so much for joining us today.